This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
I'm Pedro Mendez, and this is Editor's Choice. It's been over 40 years, but many people still don't believe the official story surrounding President Kennedy's assassination. There has been debate about a magic bullet, a puff of smoke on the grassy knoll, and of course, the legions of conspirators. Well, now lawyer and writer Vincent Bugliosi puts all these arguments to rest. In his book, Reclaiming History, he argues passionately that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Vincent Bugliosi joined Michael Enright on the Sunday edition.
Good morning, sir.
Nice to have you with us. I have to ask you what everybody asks everybody else. 12:30, November 22nd, 1963, what were you doing when you heard about the assassination?
I was in the hallway out at UCLA Law School, where I was a senior there. I don't know who told me. Someone told me. And because I was the president of the senior class, I proceeded to go into each one of the classes and announce to the students that the president had been assassinated, and then professors excused the classes for the day.
Did you believe it? Well, your first reaction, did you say to yourself?
Well, just shock like everyone else, you know, just unbelievable. And to this very day, it's a shock. People find it hard to believe, you know, that someone like the president on top of the world, and he's in a car driving down the street with his lovely wife. He's smiling. He's captivated a world audience with his intelligence and charm. And a second later, it's all over with. And people want to read more into it. They say, well, something more just had to be involved. But, of course, that's not necessarily so. Bullets are very democratic. They kill or injure whomever they hit, and it doesn't take anyone important to pull that trigger. But most people just have this visceral feeling that more had to be involved. There had to be a conspiracy.
Didn't Kennedy say himself, I think even that morning, or at least when he was in Dallas, that all it takes is somebody on a roof with a telescopic rifle and nothing can stop an assassination of a president?
Yeah, he did that in the Fort Worth Hotel. And there were two witnesses to his saying that. And he had been urged not to go to Dallas because that was a hotbed for right-wing conservatism. And in fact, one of his remarks in approaching Dallas is that we're coming into nut country now. I think that was his word. And it changed the course of history, what happened there.
You began this book in 1986, and you say in the book that you've done 99% of all of the research yourself. Were you able to look at all the available evidence, that everything that was in public view you saw?
No. There's millions of documents at the National Archives. It would take several years to look at all that. But I looked at over 500 books, plus the 40 official volumes, you know, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, who reinvestigated the case in 78, and then, of course, the all-important Warren Commission with their report and their 26 volumes. And a great number of conspiracy books, magazine articles, hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of documents were sent to me by the National Archives.
All right. Just on the point of evidence, are there some documents, some documentation that are not available to the public?
Yes and no. At the present time, I'd say that 99.9% of the documents of the archives have been released to the American public. There's a small fraction that have not. They, too, will be released in, 2007. But the important point to realize about the fraction that have not been released, I spoke to G. Robert Blakey, who was the chief counsel for the House Select Committee on Assassination, and John Tunstein, who was the head of the Assassinations Record Review Board. And both of those people told me that either they or members of the staff had seen all of the documents, 100% of them. There was no smoking gun whatsoever. But there's this small fraction. Actually, you can see the report, but there's several things that are redacted. Now, what's redacted? Well, if we can learn from experience, everything that's been redacted thus far, they all refer to the methods of operations of U.S. intelligence agencies or invasion of privacy issues. No smoking gun, but there is a small fraction of the documents that have not yet been completely released.
I wonder if we could look at some of the theory, the more prominent theories. There are so many that you talk about in conspiracy theories that you talk about in the book. Let's take the first one, and perhaps this is one of the most controversial, that Lee Harvey Oswald could not have acted alone, that he could not have fired those shots from the school book depository window in a short time with any degree of accuracy. And besides, the weapon he used, the Mannlicher Carcano, was a crappy rifle to begin with, and that he was, in his own words, a patsy.
Yeah, well, you've raised you've raised several issues here. Let me just start out with the rifle. Even if it was a $2 rifle, that was the murder weapon. Someone fired it, and there's no reason to believe that it wasn't Oswald when all the evidence points to him. So whether it was a crappy rifle or not, and by the way, the American Army test-fired that weapon hundreds of times without a misfire, and they said it was the equivalent of the M1 rifle here in the United States, but it was a $12 mail-order rifle, but it's really irrelevant because that was the murder weapon. Eight firearms experts from the House Select Committee and the Warren Commission came to that conclusion. And you know how they determine that. You know, they test fire the weapon and then they take the test fire bullets, put them under a comparison microscope with the evidence bullets, and they see if the striations match up. And if they do, that means that's the weapon. So that was the weapon, and whether it cost $1 million or $2 is irrelevant. It was a murder weapon. Now, on the difficulty of what Oswald did, it really wasn't that difficult at all. Have you ever been up to the window, Michael?
No, I haven't. I've been to the building, but not up to the window.
Well, if you go up to that window and you imagine holding a rifle, the barrel of the rifle is really pointed virtually on a straight line down Elm Street, the direction mm-hmm. in which the presidential limousine was traveling. There's a 3.9 declination of that road. The relevance of that is that it tends to eliminate the necessity of elevating the muzzle as the limousine gets farther away from the window. The limousine was traveling 11 and a half miles an hour, very, very slowly.
So the president was almost a stationary target then?
Absolutely. I asked my firearms guy in London, I don't want to put any words in your mouth, I said, but was the president essentially a stationary target? He said he was. And let's talk about how accurate he was. We have to assume that he's aiming at the head. I mean, that's the most mm-hmm. vulnerable part of the body. Well, the first bullet misses the limousine completely, and there's a reason for that, among which is that the oak tree was about to come off, to come into view, and so he had to fire it very, very quickly. The second shot hit the upper right back, exited the front of the throat, meaning it missed the head, which we assume is the target. And the third shot hits the head, so that's one out of three. The other thing the conspiracy theorists have, I don't know if they've lied about or just they don't have knowledge, they say he did it in 5.6 seconds. No, he didn't do it in 5.6 seconds. The first shot was fired around 160. The headshot at frame 313.
This is you're talking about the Zapruder film, the various frames of the Zapruder film.
Yes. I'm speaking too quickly here. And I believe that comes out to 8.2 seconds. And also, you got to realize, Michael, the clock starts to run with the first shot because the first shot, he's got all the time in the world to prepare. All he has to do is pull the trigger.
So it's already in the magazine.
That's right. Yeah. Right. So in the chamber.
In the chamber.
And
yeah.
And actually, then he only had he had about 8.2 seconds to fire two rounds. So what he did was not that unbelievable. The buffs have said no one's ever duplicated what Oswald did. That's not true. Specialist Miller in the Army at the time of the Warren Commission duplicated what Oswald did in 1967. An expert from CBS beat Oswald what he did. My firearms guy in London beat what Oswald did. And also another lie they tell is that Oswald could hit the broadside of the barn of a barn. He was a poor shot. Wrong. He fired a .212 in the military. He was a sharpshooter. He was not an expert, but he was a sharpshooter. So he wasn't that bad a shot.
All right. The other theory, the grassy knoll, that in fact the president was shot from the grassy knoll to the front and to his right because the Zapruder film shows the head snap back. And this is proof, say the conspiracy theorists, that there were two shooters, one of them in the grassy knoll.
Yeah, the head snapped at the rear. If you look at the Zapruder film, at frame 313, you see the explosion to the president's head, and you see that 8-inch snap to the rear. And that was first shown on national television in the United States in 1975. It was a national show, Geraldo Rivera, I think it was Good Night America or something like that. But an enormous number of people saw it. And the next day over the water cooler, you know, there was discussion everywhere that the shot must have come from the front, where the grassy knoll was, not from the rear, where Oswald supposedly was in the Book Depository building. Ergo, there must be a conspiracy. Now, here's the answer to that. If you look at the individual frames of the Zapruder film, you cannot see it if you look at the film itself. You cannot see it. You have to look at the individual frames. At frame 312, the president's head is okay. At frame 313, now there's 18.3 frames per second in the Zapruder film, 1/18 of a second per frame. At frame 313, that's the headshot, you see the explosion of the head. In what direction is the president's head pushed at frame 313? Well, it's pushed slightly forward, 2.3 inches, indicating what? Indicating a shot from the rear where Oswald was. So at that all-important moment of impact, the president's head was pushed forward, not backward, indicating a shot from the rear where Oswald was. And then at frames 314 to 321, you see this head snap to the rear on the film. The pathologists for the House Select Committee said it was a neuromuscular reaction. I believe they use words like nerve damage caused by the bullet to the president's brain caused his back muscles to tighten, which in turn causes his head to snap to the rear. But that is a big issue there, the head snap to the rear.
Are we absolutely certain, this event happened 44 years ago, are we absolutely certain how many bullets were fired from how many guns?
Well, the overwhelming majority of people in Dealey Plaza heard three shots. Some heard four, one heard eight, a couple heard two. Dealey Plaza resounds with echoes. I have a photo in Reclaiming History showing the sniper's nest when the authorities first located it after the assassination.
Right.
And you see three cartridge cases on the floor right beneath the sixth floor window where Oswald shot Kennedy. No fourth bullet has ever been found. So, you know, we can't be 1,000% positive, but all of the evidence indicates that only three shots were fired. The first shot, as I said, missed the president. Second shot entered his upper right back, exited the front of his throat. The third shot entered the upper right head behind the head of the president and exited the right frontal portion of his head.
Among the many conspiracy theories that you touched upon, in fact, I think at one point you give a list of something like 44 organizations that theorists say were involved in, everybody from the CIA to the Republican Party of Omaha. But I want to look at one of the Cubans. Given the tenor of the times with the Bay of Pigs and Cuba and John F. Kennedy and the Soviets and so on, is it not within the realm of imagination that indeed the Cubans might have had something to do with hiring Lee Harvey Oswald?
Well, I guess you could speculate about that, but the problem you have, of course, is that there's no evidence. And when you have no evidence, you're starting out in a very deep hole. And you have to realize that the absence of evidence of guilt is itself evidence of innocence. Of all the motives that all these groups had, that's really the anti-Castro Cuban exiles. They're the only ones that had a real motive. Why? Because they were convinced, erroneously, because Kennedy made no bones about the fact. He said, we're not going to get involved in that invasion. We're not going to participate in the invasion. They certainly helped out, but we're not going to participate in the invasion. We don't do that. That's against the traditions of America. The Cubans that were in training in Guatemala and other places, they said, well, he's just talking that way. The CIA, which is a member of the federal government, they're training us, they're paying us, they're supplying us with weapons. They're going to take us by boat to the Bay of Pigs. Obviously, when it comes to Judgment Day, they're going to be there with jets giving us air cover. Well, there was no air cover.
Right.
And the troops, it was, I think, Brigade 2506, a lot of them were slaughtered on the beach there. So you can say that the anti-Castro Cuban exiles, their father or their brother or their son was killed there, and they blamed Kennedy for withdrawing air support, which he had never promised. And you could say that they certainly had a motive. I might add that at the end of December of 62, there was really a reconciliation between Kennedy and the anti-Castro Cuban exiles. Castro had released over 1,000 Bay of Pigs soldiers that that were anti-Castro Cuban exiles, and they were in custody. And first, the indication was he was going to kill them. Then he spared their lives, and then in return for $53 million, he returned them to the United States. And they had this big celebration when they came back at the Orange Bowl down in Miami. Kennedy that was there with Jackie, and the leaders of Brigade 2506 gave Kennedy the flag of Brigade 2506 for safekeeping. And he said, "I'm confident that this flag is going to be returned to you in a free Havana." They liked Kennedy. They felt that his heart was in the right place, that he was really on their side. And so there really had been quite a reconciliation by the time of the assassination. But the main thing you got to realize is that there's no evidence connecting anti-Castro Cuban exiles with the assassination.
All right. Another theory they love, the conspiracy theorists, it was the mob. Because of Robert Kennedy, the president's brother, who was attorney general, and he led a crusade against organized crime, and because there is some tie-in with the mafia and the CIA in attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro, that it was the mob that hired Lee Harvey Oswald.
With respect to organized crime, there's not a speck of credible evidence that organized crime was involved in the assassination. Nothing at all. In fact, Michael, during the entire period of Kennedy's presidency, up to the assassination on November 22nd, 63, the FBI had been conducting extensive electronic surveillance of all the leading members of organized crime, on the National Commission, the ones who made decisions of national importance for the mob, which killing the president, I think, certainly would be. And although they heard anti-Kennedy talk and the mob discussing all types of criminal behavior, there wasn't the slightest hint in any of the hundreds upon hundreds of hours of conversations about any plot to kill the president. So again, if anyone is arguing that the mob was behind the assassination, they're starting out from an extremely weak position. There's also no evidence that Oswald ever had any contact with organized crime in any way. The other thing about the mob, Michael, in America, as opposed to Sicily, which is the origin of the mafia, the mob has absolutely no history, of ever going after public figures. I mean, even a police officer or a local city councilman, they just never do it. In Sicily, they certainly do. You know, they kill judges and detectives and everyone else. It's a part of their unwritten code. They don't do it. And here, are we to believe that in a complete departure from their long history, they're going to start out at the top of the hill killing the president of the United States, the most powerful man on earth, whose brother, Robert Kennedy, was the attorney general, the chief law enforcement officer in America? And to that I say, please. I mean, they'd literally have to be insane to do this. About Bobby Kennedy, the theory is that if they wanted to kill Kennedy to get Bobby off their back, because Bobby was pursuing them, you know, with almost a missionary zeal. But the mob would have no assurance, Michael, that Bobby wouldn't continue to be attorney general under LBJ, which he in fact did for almost a year.
So why not just shoot him?
Yeah. And if he concluded that the mob had killed his brother, they could expect a vendetta by him of almost unprecedented proportions. And so the main thing on the mob is that there's absolutely no evidence that the mob was involved in the assassination.
There are so many others, including the suggestion that LBJ, in fact, was there and fired the shots, and you go into some hilarious detail.
You're right.
But let me ask you, why these theories? Why are there so many conspiracy theories? Why are they so complex? You say at one point in the book that the murder of John Kennedy was really per se not that complicated, but for the identity of the dead man, it was pretty ordinary. You could have convicted anybody on the evidence.
Well, one reason certainly is that through their torrent of books and radio and TV talk shows and movies and college lectures, the shrill voice of the conspiracy theorists finally penetrated the consciousness of the American people, and they succeeded in completely discrediting the Warren Commission report. And also, they succeeded in convincing the majority of Americans, the overwhelming majority, that Oswald was either a member of a high-level conspiracy or just some patsy who was framed by some elaborate and exotic group of conspirators ranging from anti-Castro Cuban exiles to organized crime working in league with U.S. intelligence. And paraphrasing Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister of Hitler's Third Reich, if you push something at someone long enough, eventually they're going to start buying it, particularly if they have not been exposed to any contrary view. That's certainly one reason why people are believing in a conspiracy, but also, even apart from that, there's this instinctive notion, and I'm sure you've heard it many times before, Michael, you know, that a king cannot be struck down by a peasant. There's got to be something more involved. People found it intellectually incongruous that someone they perceived to be a king could be struck down in a moment by someone like Oswald, whom they perceived to be a peasant.
But doesn't it also give us a feeling of some comfort to think that, yes, there was something here that took this extraordinary life, and it wasn't just some lonely nut with a gun, but it was, there had to be a reason for this this particular president to die.
Yes, yeah, so that's an excellent observation on your part, Michael. In a strange way, if there was a group who killed, the belief that a group killed Kennedy because they believed he was taking the country in a direction antithetical to their interests gives more comfort, if you will, than the belief that some lone gunman flipped out and killed Kennedy. It gives more meaning, as it were, to his death and life. I mean, Jackie Kennedy herself said, we didn't even have the satisfaction of John being killed for some cause,
right,
like civil rights. She said it had to be some silly little communist, and she said it robbed the president's death of meaning. So I think you kind of hit the nail on the head here, that it gives more meaning to his death and life to believe that there was some dark force behind the assassination.
There is a virtual, and you describe it in some detail, it's almost a conspiracy industry with book after book and writers, and there are conferences, and it's a huge, I was always going to say conspiracy, but there's an actual movement out there.
It's their life, and some of the conspiracy theorists, as you know, when they read the book, they've abandoned the conspiracy theories now, and one in particular, Vince Palomara, said the conspiracy theorists were able to survive the Warren Report as well as the House Select Committee on Assassinations, but the question is, are they going to be able to survive Bugliosi's reclaiming history? And he was a firm believer in the conspiracy theory. Conspiracy is their life. I'm not exaggerating. I mean, I got a letter from a doctor a couple years ago. Said, "Mr. Bugliosi, I read all your books. I respect you, but how can you possibly believe there's no conspiracy in this case? I've been living and breathing this case for 15 years. When I go to the bathroom, I think about it. When I have breakfast, the first thought that entered my mind, I said, I hope this guy's not a surgeon who's thinking about it while he's performing surgery. Anyway, it turns out he's a radiologist. But it's their whole life, not their whole life, but the main part of their life. And they go to conventions down in Dallas. They subscribe to newsletters. They bond with other conspiracy theorists around the country. Now, I come out with my book, and basically I'm telling them that they've wasted the last 10, 15, 20 years of their lives, and people don't like to be told that. And I'm also asking them to forfeit their future. But I'm hearing from many people in the conspiracy community that reclaiming history is hitting them extremely hard, and they don't know where to go because the book has enormous credibility. I know I sound like I'm boasting, but the reviews all over the country are saying basically it's the final word on the case, and it answers all the questions.
Speaking of hitting hard, at the end of the book, you take on, I can only call it a polemic, but you go after Oliver Stone and his film JFK, and you tear it to shreds.
Well, the movie is just one continuous lie. Let me qualify that, because I do want to be fair to Oliver. He did have three things right. He had the date of the assassination, November 22nd, right. He had the location, Dallas, correctly. And he had the victim correctly. Other than that, it was just one continuous lie. And
I'm glad you're being fair to him.
The thing is, Michael, there's nothing wrong with fictionalizing an historical event as long as you call it fiction. But Stone tried to convince everyone that his fairy tale movie was the truth. In fact, he had the stratospheric arrogance to say that this was before the film came out, or maybe right around the time of the film, in an interview, that he wanted his movie to replace the Warren Report. And his movie was one lie after another. I'll just give you a couple of the lies. He depicts Oswald as a right-wing agent of U.S. intelligence, but not only isn't there any evidence that Oswald was a U.S. intelligence agency or a member of the right wing, but everyone knows he was committed to Marxism, started reading Das Kapital when he was around 15. He also shows a woman in Dealey Plaza, Jean Hill, telling the authorities right after the assassination that she saw a flash of light. And a shot comes from the grassy knoll. What he doesn't tell his audience is that she first came up with this story 26 years after the assassination. He also says Oswald was not a good shot, not telling them that he was a sharpshooter in the Marines. And we were talking about the location of Connolly in the limousine vis-a-vis Kennedy. He's got him seated directly in front of Kennedy, so the shot, the bullet's got to make a right turn.
Yeah.
And then a left turn. He just tells one lie after another. He says Ferry was murdered, but the autopsy report said he died from natural causes.
But the audiences who saw the film,
They
bought it
hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah.
Yeah, the L.A. Times, and I think it was the New York Daily News, or maybe the New York Times, or Newsday, they took polls of these young kids coming out. It was in the high 90s. They believed everything he said.
Well, what is that? What does that say to you when you're in this enormous work of yours and all those years since 1986? Do you think it is the final word, or do you think that hundreds of millions of Americans and indeed people around the world are going to go on thinking that there was a conspiracy?
Well, those that read the book, I'd say that 95 out of 100 of them, this sounds presumptuous, but you're asking me a question, I got to be candid. I think 90 to 95% of the people who read the book are going to say it's the final word, but those that don't read the book, which is the majority of people, obviously, they're going to continue believing this, of course. Of course they're going to, because, you know, you have these ideas in your mind about the head snap to the rear and the magic bullet and the sealing of the records, and if you don't read the book and see that there's an explanation for all these things, you're going to continue to believe these things.
Let me ask you finally, do you think we will ever get over the Kennedy assassination and all that flowed from it? Because, as you say, it was a watershed event, not only in American history, but I think in world history.
I have to say this about the case, and it helped me keep my interest in it for all this time, and other people have said this long before me. The Kennedy case may very well be the most interesting story that we've ever had, and that's why the most fascinating story in American history. And that's why to this very day people talk about it throughout the entire world. More words have been written about it than any other single one-day event in world history. Yeah. More people mourned Kennedy's death than any other human in history. The only country in the world that did not mourn him was China. You could get 10 of the best novelists in the world, put them in a room, give them all the time they needed to come up with a presidential assassination as intriguing and unbelievable as this one, and they wouldn't even come within 10 light years of it. I mean, the cast of characters alone rivals anything in Shakespeare. So people are interested in this case. Kennedy himself may be responsible for the continuing interest in this case and the adherence to the conspiracy theories, in that he was very, very much loved. I mean, this guy, everyone loved John F. Kennedy. Bobby was a little different. They loved him, but they also hated him. But even those that voted against Kennedy, they liked John F. Kennedy. There was something about this guy that they absolutely loved. They took his death extremely hard. Over 50% of the American public literally was reduced to tears, not feeling like crying, but actual tears. And I toss this out to you. It's a hypothesis that possibly people are, they don't want to let Kennedy go. They don't want to let him go. And one way to hang on to him is these conspiracy theories. And let me give you a tag to this thought of mine. Assuming, and I am not speaking in denigration of LBJ right. at all, but assuming that LBJ was killed under the same identical, precise circumstances as JFK, do you really believe that close to 44 years later there'd be all of this interest in this assassination, as much in LBJ's death as JFK? I really don't think so.
I don't think
How do you
so.
Feel about that?
I don't think so either. I think it was the magic of the man and the generational thing in the moment.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning. It's been quite fascinating.
It went very quickly. Thank you so much, Michael, and I appreciate all the preparation you put into this.
That was Vincent Bugliosi in conversation with Michael Enright on the Sunday edition. For Editor's Choice, I'm Pedro Mendez. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.